Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why the Navajo Nation agreed to let uranium be hauled across its land.
And how a new kind of coating could help cool buildings down.
But first, Arizonans who receive assistance from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, would no longer be able to use those benefits to buy soda, candy, and similar products under a bill under consideration by a House committee today. Lawmakers tomorrow will also hear a measure that would prevent schools from serving students ultra-processed foods during the school day, with a list of a handful of ingredients that would be banned. With me now, as he is every Monday to preview the week ahead at the state capitol, is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. But those are all the things that keep me alive, you know, candy and red dye number 40.
Oh, we don't want to see your blood results. So let's talk about this bill that would basically exclude folks who get what commonly known as food stamps, but is officially known as SNAP benefits. It would put limits on the kinds of things they could use those benefits to buy.
Exactly. Existing law has some restrictions. For example, you can't buy beer or wine. You can't buy vitamins. You can't go and get a live lobster for some reason. I don't know why that's in there. But what this proposes to do is tell the Department of Economic Security to request a waiver from the Department of Agriculture to exclude candy, soft drinks, or any other quote-unquote comparable foods from the program. The presumption is that if there's only a certain amount of money, these are not things we want folks spending their money on. This becomes a philosophical discussion in terms of, you know, where do soft drinks fit into that? What are we talking, only sugared soft drinks? Are we talking diet soft drinks? And how is that better than some of the stuff that's being sold in the middle aisles that's more water than anything else?
Well, and Howie, this is coming the same week, just the day before this bill goes through committee, as another bill that would, as you say, basically get rid of a lot of foods that that kids could be eating during the school day, at least folks, the students who buy hot lunch at school.
Oh, definitely. This is an interesting question. This obviously has come into the fore because of the fact of we've got Robert Kennedy Jr., who is heading Health and Human Services, and he has made issues of food additives, among various other issues that he's gotten into, a front page-ish question. And even the USDA has got ahead and looked at these things. For example, they very recently banned red dye number 3. This goes ahead and adds to that list and says, look, during the school day, whether it's for school lunch or snacks that you sell during the school day, there are certain things you cannot have in the ingredients. Red dye number 40, blue dye 1 or 2, a brominated vegetable oil, titanium dioxide, potassium bromate. I'm not even sure what half these chemicals are, but Representative Leo Bisucci says these are things that should not be served during the day. Now, it's important to note that if, in fact, you have some sort of snack bar at the football game at night, they're free to sell all of this stuff. And parents remain free to send any of this stuff to the school with their kids. You want to send your kid to school with a vial of green dye number 3? Have at it.
Oof. Do we have a sense, Howie, or has anybody talked about how much of the food currently in school contains these ingredients?
Well, I think a lot of it does. I think there are things there that we just don't even realize. For example, one of these items is used in the processing of bread to make it whiter, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to tell. I mean, you know, this isn't like I go to the grocery store, I can look at the ingredient there and say, okay, I don't want this. Question is, what should we feed to kids? And there's also some at least anecdotal evidence that some of these things, aside from general health effects, probably make kids a little hyper. And that's the last thing you want if you've got a bunch of kindergartners in your class.
Yeah. Howie, let me ask you about what has sort of become a perennial exercise at the Capitol, trying to do away with photo enforcement, with the photo radar cameras. Is this effort the same as what we've seen in the past?
This is a variant on the same thing. It says, look, we don't think it's fair to go ahead and use cameras to catch people for speeding and for red light running. This is a perennial, as you point out. Every year somebody introduces it. Every year somebody from Paradise Valley comes out and says, but look, our streets are safer. And if truthfully, if you're living in Paradise Valley and you don't want folks speeding through Lincoln Drive on their way to somewhere else, they'd really like to not have folks make it a speedway. Mm-hmm. There's also division, I think, in the public. I think folks don't see photo radar in terms of enforcement as fair. It's kind of a gotcha because, you know, technically speaking, the law says speed greater than reasonable and prudent. Well, what's reasonable and prudent? Well, it may depend on, is it dark? Is it day? Is the weather wet? And a camera can't do that. Now, on the other side of the equation, you have things like red light cameras. And we have a real problem here in the Valley with folks say, I can make it. And they see yellow as meaning go very, very fast. And they try to make the light, and that gets to a lot of accidents. I think more people are willing to have red light cameras because that's sort of a yes or no. That isn't a question of, you know, well, it was reasonable and prudent to go ahead and run that light. So that becomes a real issue.
Howie, obviously new crop of legislators this year. Is there any chance that this could go farther than it has in the past?
Oh, I think it might. Now, what's important to remember is that even if it doesn't get out of the legislature and is that form, there are a lot of folks say, well, maybe we should send it to the public. And that has the additional advantage of getting by Katie Hobbs and whatever she thinks of photo radar. And I truthfully haven't looked up what her driving record is, so I have no idea whether she has a lead foot or not.
All right, Howie, lastly, you got about a minute left. I want to ask you about a bill that's coming up today in a committee that would say that a hospital that accepts payments from Access, Arizona's Medicaid service, would have to list the citizenship requirements of patients. What exactly does that mean?
It seems to be just information gathering. It says that, look, if any hospital accepts Access, Arizona's healthcare cost containment, must check all the patients, not just Access patients, to determine are they in the United States legally? Are they citizens, non-citizens here? Or are they here illegally? And they provide that report to the legislature. This is another of those Wendy Rogers specials who's very much anti-illegal immigration. Doesn't seem to have a penalty. And the fact is that there is federal law that says if somebody shows up at your door in an emergent situation, you have to treat them. You don't get a chance to decide, well, you send them somewhere else, they can't pay the bill, they're not here legally. I think it's designed to be fodder to support other issues where if, in fact, we get a report that says 20% of the people being treated at the hospitals are not here legally, then it perhaps builds some pressure on the state to do something more about that. Again, I don't know if there's anything the state can do, particularly in emergent situations. As far as the hospitals are concerned, I think they just see it as yet another thing to fill out. For no particular reason at all.
Interesting. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
You're very welcome.
Last summer, the Navajo Nation was up in arms after a mining company started hauling uranium across its land. There is a uranium mine operating near the Grand Canyon, the Pinyon Plain Mine, and the company that runs it, Energy Fuels, needs to get that ore from there to its processing plant in Blanding, Utah. And they need to go across the Navajo Nation's vast lands to do it. The tribe wasn't thrilled with the environmental and health risks associated with that, but prompted by Governor Katie Hobbs's office, they entered into negotiations, and now they have reached a landmark deal. Here to explain what's in it is KJZZ's Michelle Marisco with our Fronteras desk in Flagstaff. Good morning, Michelle.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, so the deal seems a little surprising, honestly, like given the Navajo Nation's reaction to the uranium hauling that happened at the time last summer, and its kind of fraught and long history with uranium mining on its land. Is this surprising?
Yeah, it's a really delicate situation for real. The Navajo Nation has been somewhat begrudging on the matter. Navajo President Boone Nigrin, he's made no public mention on his social media about the announcement, and he's a very active president on social media. Even on the day of the agreement announcement, when Energy Fuels came out, he said nothing. And it should be noted that President Nigrin has actively joined protests against uranium transport across the nation, and he personally ordered police to stop a uranium shipment last summer.
Okay, so tell us what they agreed to here. What are the stipulations involved?
Yeah. Energy Fuels will pay the Navajo tribe $1.2 million. And that money is intended for public safety, for emergency response, for potential cleanup mitigation. It will also pay 50 cents per pound of processed uranium, equating to between $40,000 and $50,000 a month.
Okay.
For some context, the American Nuclear Society puts the price of uranium at somewhere between $70 and $80 per pound.
Wow. Okay.
The company is also going to transport and dispose of mine cleanup. This is a uranium waste left over from legacy Cold War mines, and that the waste from those mines will be headed up to Blanding, Utah for processing as well.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that in a moment, but just stop for a second, Mitchell, and remind us what the concerns are here from the Navajo Nation, especially about hauling uranium through their land. Like, they're concerned about dust, groundwater?
Yes, to both. Yeah. The Navajo Nation has just had a devastating and really uneasy relationship with uranium going back 70, 80 years now. The concerns are that the highways that the transportation routes will be taken from northern Arizona to Utah could actually be dangerous for hauling. There's already plans in place from local communities, even county and city governments, to start preparing for some sort of emergency cleanup. Mm-hmm. Dust has really been a big concern as well. The company has said that it will be using, in its own verbiage, state-of-the-art covers for the contractors' trucks to be hauling ore across the Navajo Nation. Originally, it was going to be using just tarps. And then, of course, there's the mining, which, is a precursor to the transportation. And there is a lot of groundwater access points in the area that tribes rely on, not just the Navajo, but the Havasupai, the Hualapai tribe, the concern is that uranium waste could eventually seep into some of that groundwater. So there's concerns from extracting the uranium to it finally reaching its final destination in Utah.
Yeah. Okay. Tell us a little bit more quickly, Michelle, about the cleanup of old uranium mines you mentioned. How big of a dent will that make in cleaning up the massive number of uranium waste sites on Navajo Nation land?
So Energy Fuels will be cleaning up 10,000 tons. I had asked the Navajo EPA, to please put that into context. Their estimate was one of the larger mines that needs cleanup in the area is 1 million mm-hmm. tons of wow. uranium waste.
Okay. So the big question then looming over all of this is why, right? Like, why did the Navajo Nation agree to let them haul uranium there? The cleanup probably has a lot to do with it. But is everyone satisfied with this decision?
So the Coconino County and the city of Flagstaff, they have both said, it's a tricky point for everybody because those two communities, for example, have very close relationships with the Navajo Nation, and the Navajo Nation is sovereign. The Navajo Nation ultimately didn't have a choice here, right? Mm. There's U.S. highways in the area, even though they cross sovereign nation. They characterize these as loopholes that Energy Fuels would be able to use, even if the nation doesn't want them to. So the city and the county, continue to be opposed to uranium transportation across the area. But to put it fairly bluntly, there's nothing short of legal battles that anybody could do about it.
What have Coconino County officials had to say about this?
Coconino County officials have been, they've been very opposed to it. Here's Supervisor Lena Fowler from the Coconino County Board.
We just don't want that to continue, and we will continue to be opposed to it. So that's where we are, and that's where I am. But Navajo Nation can make its own agreement as they see fit.
All right. That is KJZZ's Michelle Marisco joining us from our Fronteras desk in Flagstaff. Michelle, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, two friends enter a marriage to save one from deportation. We'll take a look into the new novel, The Broposal.
But first,
President Donald Trump followed through on his threat to impose 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico over the weekend. They, in turn, responded in kind with retaliatory tariffs of their own on us. And our next guests were there on the southern border the day before these tariffs were imposed, talking to some of the people whose livelihoods depend on trade between our state and our neighbors to the south. Mexico is, after all, our largest trading partner. Elvia Diaz is the editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, and she was on the border in Nogales on Friday alongside columnist Joanna Allhands to find out more. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's begin just with what the mood was like there, because it wasn't unexpected. Trump had been saying he was going to impose these large tariffs on Mexico. You were there just before that ended up happening. What was it like?
Well, I suppose I'll begin. It was incredibly quiet. It almost felt like the calm before the storm. So it seemed on the surface or at first glance for anyone walking there in downtown Nogales or along the border that it was business as usual, which was incredibly interesting to us or to me that we didn't see massive border patrols, you know, because President Trump has also been carrying out mass deportations, as he put it. So I will say it was very, very quiet from my standpoint, but incredibly uncertain as well. Once we were able to talk to the people, that's the sense that I got. And again, it was just right before the tariffs were supposed to be announced. And, you know, a lot has changed since then.
What was interesting is, you know, just speaking to sort of people on the street, and, you know, we were speaking to our wait staff at, you know, the restaurant and just kind of out and about. And there's so much fear out there. There's so much of just not knowing what's real and what's not. And, you know, a lot of people who are worried about going to the border or not, or what's this going to do to my livelihood. It was really interesting to see that. And then juxtaposed with meeting with people who are in the import business who really were taking this really in stride and saying, you know, we're just going to have to press forward. We're going to have to just adapt and do what we do because we don't have any other choice.
Right. So tell us about who it is that you spoke with there. These are folks who are in the trade business. This is their livelihood. The trade between our state and Mexico, right, is also just a massive amount.
It is giant, yeah, and especially produce. I don't think that people really understand how much fruits and vegetables come through the Nogales port of entry. It's massive. It's the second largest port in terms of how much food, like pounds of food, are coming past. The only one that's larger is Far Texas. It's close to like almost 7 billion pounds of food is coming through that port every year. I don't think people understand that. I also don't think people understand that we, in the last few years, have become a net importer of food, which means that we import more food than we export these days. Mm. And so, you know, things that you depend on in your grocery store, tomatoes, watermelons, cucumbers, bell peppers, grapes, table grapes, all those kinds of things are largely coming through the Nogales port of entry.
Wow. Okay. So I want to talk about the potential economic impacts just on Arizona, right? Because of what you're talking about there, because of the massive amount of trade that happens, because of the fact that we're a border state and there's trade that happens on both sides, right? Like, as you said, this is not the same balance as it used to be. What might this look like in Arizona? How might it hurt consumers?
Well, definitely prices will go up. I don't see any way around avoiding higher prices at the grocery store. Because that 25% tariff, the importers have to pay that. And, you know, there's such a small margin on fruits and vegetables anyway, the profit margin's there. There's just really no room to be able to absorb that kind of tariff and not have to pass that along to consumers. Mm-hmm. So you're going to pay more. And some people may say, well, I don't eat that kind of stuff. But, you know, those things are also used in convenience foods too. I mean, tomatoes go on your pizza. So all of those things, there'll be a trickle down if these tariffs do remain in effect for longer than just a few days as a negotiating tactic.
Okay, so let me turn to you then, Elvie, and talk a little bit about the political side of this, right? Like, do you think people are ready for the fallout that might come from this politically? Like, Trump talked about tariffs a lot on the campaign trail. He won the election. Presumably people knew this was coming.
Well, yeah, they knew this was coming, and a lot of people still want this to happen. Yeah. But you know what, on the economic impact that Joanna was talking about, normally when we write about it or you know, on radio, when we talk about it, we're talking about nearly 20 billion trade between Arizona and Sonora, just these two states, for instance, right? So we're talking about billions of dollars at stake. And then we frame this as this is what the consumer are going to pay, right? Rightly so. But then that's what we wanted to see ourselves, that it impacts so many people, because importing this tons of fruit and vegetables and all kinds of other products from Mexico and back and forth takes an enormous amount of time, of people, of, you know, different sectors. You're talking about transportation, you're talking about handlers, you're talking about salespeople. So it will impact every sector in Arizona and in the United States. So I still don't think that people understand what it will do if nothing is done. So politically speaking, we'll see what happened, right? The uncertainty is so great right now. I mean, President Trump said that he's speaking with Prime Minister Trudeau today and Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum about it. But he did say that he doesn't expect anything to change because in his words, Mexico and Canada owes the United States too much. But if Trump does keep the tariffs going, and if this continues, it will hurt every sector in the United States. So politically speaking, I don't think people get what this means, but they will. They will soon find out what it really means.
Do you think this could, though, result in, you know, putting the U.S. in a more powerful position, especially when it comes to things like immigration and Mexico?
Well, that's the uncertainty, because a lot of people, after Saturday, after the moment that Trump did announce the tariffs, were telling me and telling everyone, I was trying to read all across the board, that Trump was using the tariffs only as a negotiating tool. Mm-hmm. And if that was the case, you know, threat was enough, right? But clearly it's not. So now it's becoming clearer that he does want to collect revenue for the United States using the tariffs. So I'm beginning to think that he's not going to end them, you know, today when he speaks to his counterparts. But we'll see. I mean, clearly the United States has the upper hand. There's no question about it. But then there's the reaction for Mexico and Canada, right? I mean, Mexico is already arresting more immigrants than they have done before, non-Mexican immigrants, obviously, in the Mexican territory, which is what Trump wants. But it's he already getting what he supposedly is imposing the tariffs for. So that's why he's so uncertain.
All right. Lots to wait and see. That is Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, joined by Joanna Allhands, columnist as well this morning. Thank you both for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We just got word that President Trump has said he will pause tariffs on Mexico for a month following a series of deals with that country on border security. But tariffs on Canada and China are still set to take effect on Tuesday, at this point at least. We'll continue to follow these quickly evolving stories here and on our website. That is KJZZ.org.
A new kind of roof coating developed by an ASU spin-off company is having some success in cooling the buildings it's on. The firm, called Encoat, is testing its product at the university's Polytechnic campus, and the scientists who helped develop it say it could also serve as a moisture barrier, helping increase the lifespan of roofs. The idea of cool roof technology has been around for a little while now. With me to talk about this product and how it works is Narayanan Nathaluth, a professor in the School of Sustainable Engineering and the Built Environment at ASU. And let's start with the product itself. What exactly is it?
So right now, what has been developed by Encode is a coating system. It's a, you could do it as a one part, two part coating system, or one coat, two coat coating system, depending on what your application is and how much of an effect that you want. But we can, we have the capability, and we've actually done this in different carrier media. So now paint and coatings is one carrier media for these tunable materials, and therefore it's as a coating, but we can do it in a cementitious slurry. We can do it in concretes, like I mentioned earlier. It could be multiple avenues to doing this.
And what have you found so far in terms of how effective this can actually be?
So lots of coatings that you have in the market now reduce the temperature within a building by simply reflecting light away. And that is quite effective. You have a whole family of coatings that you have by which will just reflect light away. And by that high emissivity that you have for the coating, you have a very good advantage, and you have plenty of them that's available in the market. What this coating does, in addition to emissivity, it has a tuned controlled microstructure where there is energy absorption and release within the coating as well. So it gives you the added effect. For example, if you have external temperatures of the coating in a hot day in Phoenix, when the temperatures outside is 110, 115, a roof might be 140 Fahrenheit. But if you use a very cool roof reflective coating, you can bring down to 120, 125. This coating will bring down it even further down to 100, 105. So you get that extra differential because of how the heat is absorbed and released within the microstructure. That's a difference. That's a fundamental difference.
So how is this different from, for example, we hear a lot about cool pavement, which does a good job of making the surface temperature cooler, but doesn't do such a great job of making things, because it makes things feel warmer, like if you're walking on top of it. Like how is this product different, and how does it work differently than some of the other technologies that are out there?
Right. So very interesting question, right? So that's why I said, if you just reflect light off it, you will have a cooler, you can get the internal cooler, but when you walk on top of it, the surface is going to be hot because it's emitting a lot of energy, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas what this material does is it has a certain capacity to absorb and store heat and release heat later on. So you basically delay the heat release from an instantaneous release point of view, so that you get a better benefit. So to give you how this works is, if you apply it on a roof, typically what you do is you drop the temperature of the building inside, but you also delay when that peak temperature inside that room is reached. We call it peak load shifting. So it's very good for electrical utilities, because now not everybody is hitting their peak load at the same time. That helps the utility companies manage their loads better.
So it almost kind of sounds a little bit like a battery, in the sense that it is absorbing the heat and then releases it later.
Yes.
Presumably the goal would be to release it like after dark when it's cooled down a little bit?
Correct. So all of these materials that we have included within these coatings have temperature ranges in which they are active and they are dormant. The whole idea is to tune those. So the same IntelliCoat that you use in Phoenix will not be applicable in Chicago. The same thing that's applicable in Chicago will not be applicable in Los Angeles. You have to tune it to where the peak temperatures are and when the peak temperatures are. And similarly, what is applicable for Phoenix in summer is not going to be applicable for Phoenix in winter. But for example, we don't really need so much of heat control in winter, so that's okay. But again, based on the climate, you have to tweak it, and therefore it is, I wouldn't really call it a battery, but yeah, it has some components of heat storage and release.
I've read somebody describe this as almost like an ice pack in a cooler that kind of goes from solid to a more liquid state. How exactly does that function?
Yeah, that's exactly how it does. I mean, wouldn't be, solid, total solid to a total liquid, but some of these phase transformations happen where energy is absorbed in transforming the face. For example, if you are cooling water, if you are making it into ice, you give it energy and the energy gets absorbed into it. And then when you provide it more energy, it melts away, right? So similarly, this material also, or whatever we have tuned within these coatings, also have the capability to change from liquid to solid and solid to liquid. So when it absorbs heat, it changes from solid to liquid. When it releases heat, it becomes liquid to solid. So that transformation changes some of the heat transfer aspects. And if you can tailor it correctly with the appropriate thickness and the appropriate temperature range that you want for the application, you can influence the internal temperature in the buildings quite a bit.
So assuming that this continues to work the way that you expect it will, how big of a role do you think this product and this technology could play in the ongoing effort to try to mitigate the effects of heat and maybe bring down the temperature a little bit?
I think it's important, right? If you look at a city like Phoenix, we have tremendous built-up roof area, especially in a place like Phoenix where we are horizontally expanding rather than vertical, right? As compared to many other cities that go vertically up, we are a horizontally expanding city, which means we are creating a lot more of surface areas and a lot more of surface areas where heat gets trapped in, heat gets absorbed in. So these kinds of coatings, not just this coating, but this family of coatings, and there are several other sister technologies also that do similar benefit, but the fundamental science is different. But all of these technologies, I think, are very, very critical in making sure that we have a built environment that is resilient to the high temperatures that we are going to see even moving on further in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
Narayanan Nathalef is the Fulton Professor of Structural Materials in the School of Sustainable Engineering in the Built Environment at ASU.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The United Nations says more than 400,000 people in the Democratic Republic of Congo were displaced last month as war in that country continues. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. And Rob, where are we in this story today?
Well, the Democratic Republic of Congo is a country that is huge, you know, huge country in southern Central Africa, 108 million population, but the landmass is absolutely enormous, and it's bordered by lots of different countries. So lots of different countries have an interest, if you like, in the DRC and in stability in that region. And in the past, I'd say three decades, there's been a lot of conflict around Congo, which is very mineral rich as an environment. And of course, that's attracted all sorts of other countries and players and militias and rebels and so forth. And in fact, some estimates suggest that millions of people have lost their lives in and around the DRC in the past few decades. So this is not a country that is unused to conflict and change and instability. But what we're seeing now is a spike in that. And that's because there are some rebels in the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, called the M23 rebels. They're backed by neighboring Rwanda, and they have been doing a lot of damage in the last week or two. They've taken the eastern city of Goma in the DRC, which is a big trading and transport hub, and they've moved in on other cities. They're threatening the capital, Kinshasa. And that's bringing in all sorts of other countries. So, for example, South Africa has sent peacekeepers into Congo, 14 of whom have been killed in recent weeks. And so the big debate in South Africa is about repatriation of bodies and kind of what happened. Tanzania also says it's lost a few soldiers, Malawi as well. So the peacekeeping efforts in the region are being thwarted, if you like, by the conflict, the ongoing conflict and displacement that's going on in Congo. So this is quite a big story, and that's why you're hearing from the Trump White House, you're hearing from the EU, you're hearing from the UN, lots of international bodies really trying to de-escalate the tension, because nobody wants to see a wider war in that part of Africa, particularly right now.
Sure. Rob, let's move now to Germany, where a big election is coming up, but there's also a big conflict ahead of elections later this month. What's going on?
Yeah, so elections on February the 23rd, and the guy that we think is going to win those elections is called Friedrich Merz, and he is a conservative. He is the successor to Angela Merkel running the conservatives in Germany, but he's done something that a lot of people don't like at all, and that is that he's looked at the opinion polls and immigration is top of them ahead of these elections. And so he pushed through a resolution through Parliament last week, tightening or aiming to tighten immigration rules in Germany. And in order to get that through, he relied on the support of the far right in Germany, the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschmark for Deutschland, for Germany. And that has really upset a lot of people because there is a kind of agreement between political parties in Germany not to rely on support from the far right. And that's something that's gone back decades and, of course, is explained by Germany's history since the war and before the war and so on. So he's done that. He didn't solicit the help of the far right, but he got it anyway. And that's really upset people. That's brought out Angela Merkel, his predecessor, who's criticized him, which is a most unusual thing to do. That's kind of against protocol. And so you can see that that Germany is in some kind of tangle ahead of these elections. And in fact, something like 160,000 people were out demonstrating against this decision on the streets of Berlin yesterday. And there were similar demonstrations in other German cities on Saturday. So this has really touched a nerve in Germany ahead of these elections.
Well, that's really interesting. All right, Rob, finally, let's go to Japan, where a new report shows the number of foreign workers in that country has reached a record high. Why is that happening?
Well, yes, you're right. So the number of foreign workers in Japan has reached a record high. What they're saying, or a new report says, that last year the foreign workforce grew by more than 250,000 to a total of 2.3 million. Now, if you consider that the Japanese population is 123 million, that is only a very small number. However, this is a very homogenous, traditional, conservative society, and the number of foreign workers, the number of immigrants to Japan has always been kept extremely low, a kind of unusually low amongst large countries like that. Well, now it's increasing. In fact, it's increased threefold since 2014, so in about the last decade. And that's because Japan has a very aging society, so it needs young workers coming in to do the jobs that Japanese people won't do. And that's why it has lots of Vietnamese, Filipinos, Chinese coming in to do these jobs. Actually, it's an interesting fact that Japan has the world's second oldest population after Monaco, of all places. On the Mediterranean. So it really is an aging population. They've had to beef up the number of foreign workers, and that's why this report's just come out saying the numbers are effectively soaring from where they were. So an interesting kind of demographic change going on in the world's fourth largest economy.
Indeed. All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones in London. Rob, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The premise of Sonora Reyes' new novel will be familiar to rom-com fans. Two best friends realize they're in love. But Reyes puts a few interesting twists on that familiar story. For starters, the two best friends, Kenny and Han, are both men. The whole thing starts because Han is undocumented, so Kenny comes up with the idea that they should get fake married so Han can get a green card. After that, they assure each other they can totally drop the ruse. Except it turns out not to be a ruse. The guys have been pals since they were 6 years old, and before long, it turns out their intimacy goes deeper than either of them realized. The book is called The Broposal, and Reyes presents the story in the form of alternating diary entries from Kenny and Han, with each of them telling the story from their own perspective. The show's Sam Dingman spoke with Reyes recently, and they told him that this character-centered approach is their favorite way to write.
One of the things that I have a lot of fun with all of my books is the character voices. I really try to like get in their head when I write and just like be that person in at least the parts that I'm writing from their perspective. So I'm autistic, and I didn't actually decide to make Han like canonically autistic until one of the way later drafts, and that really unlocked his character voice for me.
Could you give me an example of maybe something about him or his voice that changed once you made that choice?
Yeah. So for example, thinking that he's straight before he realizes that he's fallen for Kenny, because I do think autism and like sexuality a lot of the time can go hand in hand, because you have this black and white thinking. So, you know, when other people are seeing his chemistry with Kenny, and they're like, kind of like, people make jokes like laughing because like, oh my God, they're so married, or they're so boyfriends, even before they were even
right
supposed to get married. And Han's like, oh yeah, it's funny because I'm straight, and that is the joke. They're making a joke because I am straight, and it's
right.
Right. So he's just like, that black and white thinking like made it really click for me, like why he doesn't get it.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Well, because there's also, I think, a couple moments in the book where he says to us, the reader, well, I have only dated women previously, therefore I am straight. And then there's also a really interesting part where he's starting to realize that he might not be straight, where he says to us, I have only dated women, but I've never really wanted to have anything long term with them. And then he realizes like, oh, maybe it's because I don't want them. Oh, I don't want them. I must be gay. He's still trusting the linearity mm-hmm. of his feelings. It's just that he's realizing that line points in a different direction.
Yeah. He's a very like, it's like like a very like, okay, A plus B, like it's very like mathematical for him.
Yeah. So there's also a pretty intense villain in the story, in the form of Jackie, Kenny's longtime girlfriend, who is very emotionally abusive towards him, is physically abusive. She's also a bit of a stalker. She's a tough character. Mm-hmm. How did you find her, and what was the work that went into bringing her into focus?
I think a lot of people who haven't met a Jackie before may think that it's a little unrealistic. But I really did think it was important to have her as a character in there, because I think, you know, abuse towards men can be so understated. And I think there's a lot of just like brushing it aside. When I write stories, my thing is like, I love a happy ending. But for me, the happy ending feels so much more earned if like me as my own, you know, damaged, wounded self can really relate to the characters who earn that happy ending.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things that's really compelling in the book to me is that for Kenny, it seems it's much more about him learning that he has to live with the reality of who Jackie is, and that he can't fix any of the very real problems and traumas that she is dealing with.
Yeah, I think the point of Kenny's arc is not to aid her in that journey. It's to know that he's not responsible for that journey.
Yeah. You're making me realize as we're talking about this that it feels like a lot of what you're writing about in this book is people realizing what others' capacities are.
Yeah, I think, you know, Kenny and Han, obviously, they've been in community with each other for their entire lives. They have their families. They have, you know, Letty and Tatiana and these other characters who are their community. And then there are people who they kind of have to, I don't know if leave behind is the right term, but they do have to kind of like let go of.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up their family members, at least in the case of Letty. Because one of the book's pleasant surprises is that both characters' families are, for the most part, pretty open-minded and welcoming. Was there ever a version of this where the family dynamic was more a source of tension?
Not for this book, no. I have like other books where it's more found family, and it's more like, you know, there's a lot of familial strife. But for this book, I think especially because these two guys have been best friends since they're like six, their families are already so in love with both of them, right? So mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They do kind of come out, but it's not a surprise to anyone. Everyone's like, oh yeah, we knew.
It's almost like they're more coming out to themselves.
Yeah, than exactly. Exactly. Families,
which I really enjoyed. I mean, I think it's kind of expected in romance stories and maybe even, you know, fiction about young love and young queer love in particular. It's like we're almost bracing for the family strife, as you were putting it. But it struck me that you chose to write about something that is more nuanced and I thought also more familiar, which is this sense of your family knowing you a little bit better than you do and being mm-hmm. a little bit emotionally ahead of you and knowing that they just need to give you the space to get there.
Yeah. I think especially with Han's family, because his cousin is Letty, who's trans, non-binary, and like they have been out of the closet for way longer than Han. So like his family has been primed for another coming out, and he's not, you know, necessarily worried about their reception or anything like that. And like he lived with, you know, Letty growing up, like they raised him. His problem isn't the family's acceptance. It's him figuring himself out.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing I have to say that struck me as a bit of an inversion of other stories of this kind is the fact that both of these characters, they're pretty sexually liberated. Kenny and Jackie split up at one point, and like the first thing Kenny does is download Grindr and like invite somebody to come over for a hookup. And we find out early on that almost all of Han's romantic experience up to the point of this book is casual hookups. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's actually real intimacy and trust that mm-hmm. neither of them has had before and maybe even didn't know they were looking for.
I wanted to do a couple things with it. Like, first, I wanted it to be pretty sex positive, but mm-hmm. also with the intimacy of like really having someone that you fully trust is so different. What I was really trying to emphasize with them is just like the safety in knowing someone and communicating with them in an almost like unsexy way, if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting because I found the intimate moments between them much less about sex and much mm-hmm. more about them learning how to talk to each other in a way that they didn't realize they needed to learn because they think they know each other so well.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Well, I have been speaking with Sonora Reyes. Their new book is The Broposal. Sonora, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.